everyone, welcome back to Blame Theory, a podcast that takes a seriously playful look at the ideas that have shaped our minds and our world and asks, how have we ended up here and whom or what can we blame? So today we're going back to the beginning, or one of the possible beginnings, and no less an authority than Friedrich Nietzsche, who we'll be discussing extensively. In fact, cites the era we'll be talking about as the era of the birth of theory itself. When in The Birth of Tragedy, he's discussing the figure of Socrates, who's one of the philosophers we will be discussing, as the type of an unheard of form of existence, the type of theoretical man. So for Nietzsche, this is the moment at which theory first emerges. In some form we can recognize. Possible synonyms would be both philosophy and science. This is, of course, not an uncommon idea, right? That ancient Greece is the cradle of what we would recognize as philosophical thought, as well as scientific investigation. And so we will consider this notion partly through the work of Nietzsche, who does assign considerable blame to particularly the figure of Socrates, but to this period for bringing about a shift away from what he described as the tragic as a sensibility, which he set in opposition to the theoretical, the tragic and the theoretical as antitheses. So we'll consider Nietzsche's account of this moment of origin, as well as that of the Marxist theorist Alfred Sohn-Raetl in his book Intellectual Manual Labor. So these are quite different, but in some respects congruent accounts of why we might blame the Greeks. And specifically today we'll be focusing on the figures usually called the pre-Socratic, although in this case we will use Nietzsche's term, the pre-Platonic, because we will include Socrates within this group. So perhaps to start us off, Nina, Nietzsche delivered a series of lectures in Basel, which were not published until relatively recently, and they weren't published during his lifetime. They were compiled into book form and translated and published within the past couple decades. And so these are, you know, part of his sort of posthumous corpus, but they are, you know, quite significant in understanding Nietzsche's thought, and particularly how he thought about the Greeks, which, you know, was a subject he never tired of thinking about throughout his career. And so, you know, to begin, perhaps, Nina, you could introduce us to this set of lectures on the pre-Socratics and how exactly Nietzsche understands them and what sort of possible blame narratives his account sets up.
Yes, absolutely. So obviously blaming the Greeks is a bit like blaming the sun. But we're interested in, I suppose, where abstract thought comes from in the first place. So this is why we're kind of beginning at the beginning. And this is really the kind of classical beginning of Western thought. And if you're taught anything about Western thought, it's that it begins with the Greeks. And I suppose the question we're pushing into here is how and why does it begin with the Greeks? Like, what exactly happens to humanity at this point? And did it need to happen? And where has it got us? So we generally associate the Greeks with inventing all kinds of things like democracy, tragedy, science, philosophy, you already mentioned, and possibly coins. And money will feature later in our discussion as a possible in relation to the origin of abstract thought. But I'm going to focus on this very beautiful collection of lectures that are probably from around 1869 to 70. The very nice collection translated and edited and introduced by a Nietzsche scholar called Greg Whitlock. It wasn't released until 2006. It's entitled The Pre-Platonic Philosophers. And I think, yeah, it's as Jeff already mentioned, it's really important for Nietzsche that Socrates is included with the first batch of Greek philosophers, right? So the nature philosophers, all of those theorists that we remember come up with the idea that everything is made of water, for example, in Thales, or everything is made of elements, or everything is in a process of flux and becoming for Heraclitus, or everything is a big block of being for Parmenides, and so on. So we know about these kind of origin theories. And Socrates, I think, is a very ambivalent figure for Nietzsche, but I think fundamentally he describes Socrates in these lectures as the first philosopher of life. So whereas for Socrates, thought serves life, while in all previous philosophers, life served thought and knowledge, right? So Socrates for Nietzsche is this kind of thinker who is eminently practical. He's actually at odds with the kind of tendency towards abstraction that is also going on at this moment. Philosophy begins in wonder. We're very actually familiar with this argument. It's one that Heidegger repeats, this idea of Thou might say, and that we are astounded by the world suddenly, collectively, for the first time. And Nietzsche makes this point too. He says, now for the first time, mundane existence appears to the free spirit worthy of contemplation as a problem. So this is something that's happening in the Greeks. We don't yet know why. Nietzsche describes philosophy as the art that presents an image of universal existence in concepts. He talks about Thales being the first unmythological thinker, which is very interesting because one of the great separations we tend to make classically is the idea that and actually it is still mixed in some of the early philosophers like Parmenides' poem, for example, but this idea that there is a shift or some parts of some explanations are moving from a mythological account or a theological account to something that resembles a proto-rationalism, something that resembles a kind of hypothesis about the world. We're not yet, of course, in the realm of empirical science. We're not thinking about the scientific method. We don't yet have those separations. Maybe there's a problem with that separation, the idea that we separate philosophy from science. This is certainly a question that Husserl and Heidegger ask in the early 20th century. But for the time being, you know, in Nietzsche's account, we have this unmythological attempt to overcome a poetic description of the universe. So it's not simply a story about the gods or what the gods are doing, although Nietzsche makes it very clear that he thinks what the Greeks excel in, their peculiar genius, is the harmonization and systematization of the gods. And it's this systematization of the gods, like bringing together, for example, the Orphic mysteries with the Hellenic gods, with other kinds of theories of gods and their rank, as he puts it, that in this attempt to create a harmony of a vision of the universe through systematization and rank, that this is in a way the induction of non-mythological thought. It sets the ground for the possibility of making these grand universal claims about existence. So, for example, the earliest one is Thales, everything is made of water. This is a assertion. It's a claim about how things really are. It's not a story. It's not trying to sound particularly beautiful. We think that Thales' claim today is both brilliant and sort of insane. We can perhaps understand why he made this claim that everything is made of water. It does make sense if you think about plants and humanity and how we stay alive, and on a deeper level as well. But it's his first attempt really at an unmythological overcoming of the poetic, as Nietzsche puts it. And we could say that this is a very interesting claim that Nietzsche makes, right? That the idea that the desire for harmony and the systematization of the various gods and mystery accounts actually lays the ground for systematic thinking altogether. But Socrates then is a kind of strange character because he's not exactly a nature philosopher in the same way. He's not making these ontological claims. He's actually rather more moral philosopher insofar as we know anything about him at all, which is all from secondary accounts, obviously Plato, but also from various plays. He's often portrayed as this kind of buffoon. He's kind of ugly, explicitly sort of playful. He's clearly trouble. He's a great user of irony. He's turning these young men away from their roles in society. He's not a sophist because he doesn't accept money for his work. So he renders philosophy right from the beginning, not exactly a profession, but really more a vocation. He's a figure that is guided by his so-called daimon, his inner voice, not quite a demon, but a sort of voice of conscience, which often leads him into trouble, gets him into trouble. He says the wrong thing. He's a very non-normative character. And later on, we'll see echoes of him in figures like Diogenes, well, especially Diogenes, let's say, who's like a kind of punk Socrates on the outskirts of Greece. But yes, let's just sort of say a little bit more about what Nietzsche's saying here. So the Greeks produce, Nietzsche says, originally a pure type of philosopher. With Plato, philosophy and the philosopher become mixed. But it's with the Greeks that we get the archetypal image of the philosopher, and not just one kind of philosopher, but several. So it's the Greek genius that produces these various characters. These are all great individuals. And Nietzsche, of course, is very interested in great individuals with original conceptions. Socrates, he says, is the last pure type. So even though he's not a nature philosopher, he is a life philosopher. What is a philosopher of life? Well, I've already kind of mentioned that a little bit. It's the idea that philosophy is not a profession, but rather a way of life. It's a practice. It is for everyone. It is popular. Socrates tells people that virtue may be taught. It is not simply something that is transmitted socially as a form of normal social reproduction, but rather will often put you or potentially put you at odds with the society in which you find yourself in. But it is in principle open to everyone. So we could say that one of the great inventions of Socrates in particular is a form of popular and democratic thinking as a practical mode of life. Which is something that comes back again and again whenever philosophy becomes too abstract, too categorical, too obsessed with making divisions and distinctions and fine-tuning itself. Someone will come along and say, but what about life, damn it? And yeah, I'll leave Nietzsche there for the moment.
And I think we could say Nietzsche himself is sort of an ambiguous figure in this respect, right? Because he's clearly a kind of, someone who breaks from the academic establishment and sets himself against it and writes these formally quite strange and radical texts that are not meant to be read by sort of official philosophy or responded to in that context. But nevertheless, he also is a, overt elitist and sort of, and opposes Socrates precisely for his democratic instincts, right? That he sees Socrates as a figure of the rabble or the mob, as he puts it, right? And his ugliness, his physical ugliness, as he says at some point, is already in sort of ancient Greek culture an argument against him, right? Sort of, in a culture in which beauty is considered primary, his ugliness and the fact that someone who is this ugly is taken to be so wise and is sort of idolized by all of these figures of the Athenian nobility is for him symptomatic of a problem, right? That something's gone wrong here in some sense. And so, one thing about the previous philosophers who he has the most positive things to say about throughout his career is Heraclitus, right? Who he at some point says is one of his predecessors, one of his forebears, Empedocles as well, but Heraclitus in particular, and maybe we can get into that. But it is also that these other pre-Platonic figures are generally, I think, figures of the nobility, right? And who are mm-hmm. sort of representatives of the Greek upper class aristocracy. And so, and they're sort of, he sees them as sort of aristocrats of the spirit, or he says at some point tyrants of the spirit, which is interesting in relation to the development of tyranny in this period as a kind of defense of privilege, of the privilege of the nobility over and against the democratic demands of the the mob, the plebeian class, which, as an aside, is sort of the theme of this book, Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy, that I wrote about for Compact last year. But without getting too deeply into that, you know, it is notable that part of what, and I'll just say one other thing, that I think part of what drives Nietzsche's fascination with these figures is, in The Birth of Tragedy, he repeatedly invokes this idea of a music practicing or a music playing Socrates. So his question is sort of, can there be a music playing Socrates? I think in some not all that subtle sense, he's referring to himself or his aspiration for himself there. that in some sense, you know, Socrates, the theoretical man and the tragic man, right? Tragedy is born out of the spirit of music. The theoretical man and the tragic man are antitheses, and they're not productive antitheses in the way that the Dionysian and the Apollinian are, right? The Socratic and the Socratic sort of dissolves the Dionysian rather than existing in this kind of fruitful interplay with it as the Apollinian does. But, you know, for him, he is holding out this promise of, you know, perhaps there can be a music playing Socrates. In other words, someone who embodies the theoretical, the scientific, the philosophical, but can also be reconciled with the spirit of music. And, you know, in The Birth of Tragedy, which is in some sense his most kind of culturally optimistic work, you know, it's when he's very much, you know, he dedicates it to Wagner and sees it as a kind of philosophical adjunct to this project of cultural renewal that he places Wagner at the center of. And so, you know, he, I think in some sense, wants to see himself as the music practicing Socrates, who will in some sense recapture the potential of philosophy that he sees in this early period that he thinks is lost after it, even though already within this early period, the kind of seeds of what he laments in the later period are being laid, right? Mm-hmm. Or are being sown, I should say. I think there's you know, and so there's always a kind of ambivalence for him, I would say, around Socrates, who's kind of this figure he wrestles with throughout his career and his earliest and latest work. He's very central. But, you know, that these other figures seem to represent some other possibility. And then you mentioned Heidegger before. Heidegger sort of picks up this idea too, right? That the question of being, as he sees it, is sort of raised in these pre-Platonic or pre-Socratic philosophers before it is foreclosed, right? As he sees it, you know, with the rise of Platonism. So, you know, it both represents the point at which there's kind of the beginning of a wrong turn, but at the same time, the seeds of some kind of potential alternative path for philosophical thought.
I mean, I don't know, Jeff, if you've ever heard any of Nietzsche's compositions. I have, unfortunately. he doesn't quite manage to be a musical Socrates. I think, you know, one of the things
I think I did a while ago, but...
Yeah.
They seemed forgettable, sadly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the other sort of paradoxes or difficulties with Socrates is the martyrdom as well. I think, you know, for a philosopher of life to kind of willingly submit, as Nietzsche basically understands it, to the judgment, the death penalty of the court, is a kind of giving up. I think Nietzsche is not kind of pro this move. I happen to be of the opinion that Socrates doesn't actually die, and he does turn up in later dialogues.
Socrates truther.
I am.
Amazing.
I think he's the old Athenian in later dialogues. But anyway, leaving that aside.
so he fakes his own death.
Well, that I think his friends basically sort of help him escape. But it's a good myth to have him dead. No, he probably does die, but it's fine. I always don't want people to die, so I think it's probably my wish fulfillment.
This should be a separate episode, really. But
but the other important point here, as you raise, is tragedy, is the idea of tragedy. And the origin of tragedy with the Greeks, or the birth of tragedy, and it's a very, very interesting and quite beautiful argument by Walter Ong, talking about the relationship between writing and tragedy, in which he more or less says that the invention of writing, of invention of tragedy, or the sort of coming about of tragedy in the Greeks, is a kind of way of coping with the invention of writing, because for the first time you have this technology which creates what he calls a schizophrenia, a kind of separation of voice and body. So you can hear people who aren't there, which induces a deep social pain, right? So at once this technology is enormously useful. You can record things, you can send letters and messages, but it breaks this need for somebody to be there, so that there, it creates also the ground for a kind of alienation and separation, even at the same time as text is democratic, and Derrida will make much of this invention of writing as a democratic technology. So tragedy, in a way, is a way of coming together collectively, and Nietzsche is obsessed in the early work with this idea of the Dionysian as a kind of collective de-individuating experience, right? So the cathartic practice of tragedy and the experience at a distance of pain and suffering as a collective enterprise, which can go horribly wrong, of course, right? And the Dionysian is very close to some of the dangerous things that happen when people lose their mind and get into a frenzy and start tearing each other limb from limb, whether they're sort of drunk or high. And, you know, we've got the mystery cults in the background too. You know, the Greeks are kind of dealing with all of this stuff very beautifully and tragically, we might say. But yeah, it's a kind of collective de-individuation. And it's something that, yeah, as you say, in the early days, Nietzsche is optimistic that German culture can somehow resurrect through the work of Wagner. Though, of course, later on, Nietzsche himself will blame Wagner for what he describes as a kind of decadent, corrupt numbing of the German soul in their desire for this kind of overblown, ridiculous, full-on sensoria. Why can't they just enjoy a walk in the countryside, for goodness sake? Why do they need all of this insane pomp and singing and shouting and decor, and, you know, what's happened to their nerves? I don't know what Nietzsche would make of IMAX cinema today. He'd probably be absolutely appalled by the level of stimulation that contemporary Western man and woman needs in order to feel anything at all. But there you have it.
Yeah, so you bring up this point about, and there should probably be a separate episode on blame writing at some point, because
yes,
this whole question of literacy is so, there's such a rich and fascinating literature, including Ong and various other media theorists, media ecologists. But what interests me here is the point about separation, because I think that's one kind of through line we can draw through these figures in this category of the pre-Platonics. Now, you know, Plato is known for sort of separating sensory experience from the sort of pure realm of ideas. But already, and this is where I think, you know, we can both say you have the path, as Nietzsche and later Heidegger see it, towards some alternative version of philosophy, but at the same time, the seeds of what becomes sort of standardized in philosophy, up until figures like Husserl and Heidegger, I think, try to, you know, through phenomenology, end this kind of splitting. But that you have the splitting between, I think, what Parmenides calls aletheia and doxa, right, which is something like truth and something like opinion, right, is one version of it. Doxa, of course, is a term that, you know, still gets used quite a bit today, is revived and becomes central to the sociology of Bourdieu. But, you know, this idea of doxa as what, you know, what people say, just kind of opinion, as opposed to true belief or true knowledge or knowledge of the truth, is a distinction and a separation that's set up. Another way to understand it is the distinction between appearance and reality, between what Kant will later call, you know, the phenomena and the noumena. And already in all of these pre-Platonic philosophers, you get different versions of this, right? So you mentioned Thales. For Thales, you know, the noumenal or the realm of truth, you know, is that in which everything is water, right? But in the realm of appearances, you know, it does not appear that way to us, right? So there's a contradiction between our experiences as filtered through the senses and some truth that we can come to independent of that and that in some sense transcends that. And another thing that's important here is that these are not, you know, that you may have versions of this previously, but they tend, you brought up the mystery religions. You know, you have versions of this idea of a sort of truth concealed from the masses, but prior to this, they tend to be filtered through some idea of a divine revelation, right? That there's some process of religious revelation that, you know, leads some select few to the truth. Whereas here with these thinkers, we first get the idea that there's a sort of common wisdom. And again, this relates to the kind of democratizing tendency of this, that there's a common wisdom or a kind of rational procedure by which we can come to accept these truths that is not, you know, simply the result of some sort of divine revelation to a select elite, but instead is something that can be apprehended generally and universally, right? So the truths are themselves universal and pertain to the kind of universal substrate of reality. And at the same time, they're universally comprehensible, right? They're universally approachable through a sort of procedure of rational thought. And so this, you know, this basic idea on one hand that there is a split or a division between the realm of appearances, the realm of illusions, we might say, or simply of phenomena, and the realm of truth, right, which is in some sense concealed behind these phenomena, is, you know, one that we get in various forms among the pre-Platonic thinkers. And that they, in different ways, you know, posit that there's an ultimate reality that can be apprehended behind what we can sense and what sort of average people think. And, you know, the interesting one of these theories that Nietzsche highlights is that of Heraclitus, because for him, Heraclitus kind of deconstructs this approach. Because in some sense he sees the realm, you know, as opposed to the idea that there's a realm of being that is sort of fixed and permanent and stable behind the flux of appearances. He, in a sense, posits the opposite, right? And this is what's important for Nietzsche, that the what's primordial is the flux, right? And this is, of course, the stuff that Heraclitus is famous for, right? You can't step in the same river twice and things like that. That the fundamental reality is one of flux and constant change and instability. And what would be illusory is the realm of being, right, of some kind of fixed permanent forms. And so this is at least the way Nietzsche reads Heraclitus as kind of formally approaching these fundamental questions in the same way as these other pre-Platonic thinkers, but as, in a sense, kind of deconstructing or sort of undermining the procedure by, instead of trying to find some stable, permanent reality beneath the flux of appearances, positing the flux itself as the, you know, paradoxical permanent reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the Greeks, especially Heraclitus, but also Parmenides, although Nietzsche is not such a fan of Parmenides, but are full of these kind of paradoxes and these almost like these kind of epigrams, like nature loves to hide, and, you know, like these things that you can sort of ponder. They're like Zen koans, and you can kind of enter into like meditative state by sitting next to a stream. And I suppose just to go back to the provocation of blaming the Greeks, right? We might, you know, it is still quite strange. Like often when you're taught the classical story of the Greeks as the first philosophers, at least in the Western tradition, and so on. And this is still basically assumed. And often it's a very partial story. Like you get some of the philosophy and not the science. And it's all a bit, you know, one-sided perhaps, and a bit shallow. like a stream. I suppose there are kind of these harder questions, though, really, about what else is happening in the world, right? Like questions like you've already brought up the question of social class, of caste, perhaps, of ranking, of hierarchy. You know, it's also a world that is filled with war and slavery, and certain exclusions of various groups of people, like women, for example. And, you know, it's interesting to try to ask a sort of deeper social and materialist, historically materialist question about what is going on here, like these practices that may themselves be contributing to this origin of thought, if we are going to locate it, a particular kind of thought. As I said, I really appreciated Nietzsche's idea of the unmythological, because it's actually quite a minimalist way of putting it, like the unmythological, right? It doesn't kind of elevate it. But there is a kind of deep question about abstraction. You know, we live in a world that is filled with abstractions. There are millions and millions of things that we can't necessarily understand, but depend upon there being things that we can't see and don't know how they work, right? The modern world is absolutely filled with abstract processes, in the sense that they do not appear to us. We might see one part of the process. We might receive, for example, an object, but we don't necessarily think about where it came from, how it was made, and so on, and all of the things that went into it, like labor and so on, right? So we're getting closer to a sort of materialist theory of production. But there's some very, very interesting work by Zonrettel and others who are working in this area. For example, George Thompson is somebody that Zonrettel draws upon. Also Richard Seaford, who are kind of looking at the empirical, historical emergence of things like exchange in the form of money, right? And money is obviously the great, we are still in a money world, something that permits exchange, but also the most extraordinary kind of abstraction, in the idea of the principle that anything can be exchanged for anything else through this universal medium of exchange, which is money. And it's very obvious when you start to think of it like that. It's one of those bizarrely simple points, a bit like some of Girard, where you're like, well, this seems too simple to be true, but true it may be. And that is to say that the implications of an abstract system of exchange for then the possibility of abstraction altogether, and let's say to make distinctions between appearance and reality, or between the idea of truth and appearance. And aletheia for the Greeks, you already mentioned, is perhaps something more like a kind of uncovering or an unveiling. You know, you have all these ideas of a kind of mystery that perhaps doesn't belong to everyone. Again, the question of class and who is allowed to know what. You know, now we have technical knowledge, right? We have people who are scientists who know about theoretical physics, right? And most people don't know anything about theoretical physics, or they know a kind of popular version. But here, perhaps it's more closely still tied to positions of nobility, questions of theology, those who are somehow closer to the gods, and so on, rather than those people who have advanced technical, almost bureaucratic knowledge in our age. But Zonrettel is wrote this crazy book. I mean, it has to be said, he says himself it's absolutely mad, and nobody paid any attention to him. He was sort of friends with people from the Frankfurt School, and he was sort of friends with Adorno, and you know, he had a few people supporting him, but he was largely working on his, as he says, ED fix, you know, his one obsessive idea about the origin of intellectual, what he calls the fetishization of the intellect, and this original split between the head and the hand, right? This idea that there is an invention of abstract thought which takes people away dramatically from practical life, and that this separation and this alienation, this aloneness, this schizophrenia, whatever we want to call it, it has to be understood in relation to these other abstract systems, which are deeply, in fact, material, so that there is a material origin for the possibility of abstract thought in humanity. So it's a kind of historical, anthropological, materialist argument about abstraction. So abstraction doesn't just descend from the sky in some kind of magical moment and suddenly the Greeks, like a monolith has appeared and suddenly they're able to think abstractly. But no, it comes from probably selling slaves for money. You know, it's like this. What do you think, Jeff?
Yeah, I find this book quite compelling, intellectual manual labor. And I remember coming across the argument for the first time in Zizek's first book, The Sublime Object of Ideology, which, you know, as you said, I think Zora Neale himself was somewhat ignored and forgotten. And I believe that book may have done something to revive his reputation or perhaps, you know, give him something of a reputation in the first place, because I don't know how widely read he was before that. But the concept that stuck with me from it is this notion of real abstraction, which is, you know, seemingly yeah. paradoxical term, but it's this notion that, and you made clear how it's very relevant to just everyday life today, right? That all of us go around in our lives doing real, you know, performing real actions that embed us in these abstract systems that we can't really comprehend or and certainly can't apprehend, you know, sensorially. So they are abstract in that sense, right? That we are all practically engaged in abstraction, right? So this is sort of the alternative way of thinking about abstraction that he offers, right? That it's not simply a thing that you think, but it's something that you're permanently engaged in, you know, in a society dominated by the commodity form, the, you know, commodity fetishism, where, you know, abstraction in this sense emerges from what Marx called exchange value, right? Where you have, in a sense, a split embedded in the commodity, right? And, you know, in Marx's famous chapter about commodity fetishism, which I don't have in front of me, you know, he makes a version of this type of argument or analysis that we've been associating with the pre-Platonics, right? Which is that, you know, a commodity at first appears a very simple thing, right? But once you kind of try to look into its secret, you know, it abounds in what he, I believe, calls metaphysical niceties and theological niceties, right? So it's a version of this sort of appearance and being split, right? Where, you know, but interestingly, as Zizek often points out, you know, what he's doing here is in some sense a reversal, right? Where it's not that it's confusing up front, but then once you go behind it, it turns out to be quite straightforward. It's actually that, you know, it seems and looks and can be experienced as something quite simple, but if you actually try to make sense of it, it is, you know, as he said, a sort of metaphysical and theological paradox, right? And so, you know, this, I think, you know, important point that Zora Neale brings in is this notion of real abstraction, right? That when you exist in a society organized around the exchange of commodities, right? Where, simply put, you know, every object has an exchange value, and in that sense is in its existence and circulation is kind of embedded in an abstract system of exchange, right? Through money, and this is something, you know, kind of bringing us back towards the Greeks, you know, the emergence of money as a kind of universal medium of exchange is occurring in the Eastern Mediterranean in this period, right? In these kind of commercial mercantile societies. And so in that sense, you know, again, you have the subordination of use value, in other words, of just the way you would take a commodity and you know, find some kind of practical purpose for it, to this these systems of abstract exchange, right, which are mediated through money. And so for him, the idea is that, you know, that this type of thought can only really emerge in the context of the emergence of real abstraction, right? And kind of lays the groundwork for it, right? That before you can have abstract thought and the emergence of kind of abstraction as a philosophical pursuit, you have to first have the emergence of real abstraction, which occurs through the commodification embedded in sort of market relations and market exchange. And so, right. You know, just to quote a little bit from him, he said, you know, talking about the figures that we've been discussing, the first pure thinker emerging with a concept fitting the description of the abstract material of money, but without any idea of what the concept stood for and what had prompted him to conceive it, was the ancient Greek Parmenides. So, you know, then he goes on, it is, you know, his Parmenides' notion of the one or that which is unchanging through time, fills all space, lacks all properties and of sense perception, is strictly homogeneous and uniform, indivisible, incapable of becoming or perishing, and is forever at rest. He stresses that its reality or being is of such a kind that it is inherently impossible to think that it is not. So his argument here is really that in order to have the thought of this kind of universal substance, you first have to have the existence of the universal substance of money, right? Of coinage as a sort of abstract medium of exchange that enables the emergence of the commodity as we would now continue to understand it. And of, you know, what I was just describing as real abstraction. So I don't know if did I get that right? I did my best to summarize his argument.
But, no, I think so.
I do find it pretty compelling overall.
Yes. I mean, a couple of things. I mean, one of which would be, yes, that we're not talking just also about speculative thought, right? So like where people are kind of saying, well, maybe this, maybe that. But the kind of claims that are being made, like by Pythagoras, like everything is made of numbers or reducible to numbers, require that thought itself become a kind of medium, right? So that this idea of real abstraction and the translation or the transmission of an understanding of something like, well, the universal equivalence of money, creates the idea of equivalence itself, which then becomes a form of mediation in thought itself, for the capacity to say something like, well, all matter is ultimately reducible to numbers, let's say, or everything is reducible to four elements, or everything is everything is being, everything is static, everything is flowing, everything is moving, right? So there's something about thought itself and consciousness for the Greeks that becomes a kind of universal equivalent, right? Because these kind of claims are a mapping onto that possibility, which is presented by the real abstraction of money as mediation. I think the other thing that Zonrettl talks about is the downgrading of manual labor as well, right? So that the kind of fetishization of the intellect corresponds or is coterminous really with the denigration of manual labor. And we always or often still see this idea, right? Like the idea that people who work with their hands or who are practical are somehow not involved in intellectual life, even though, you know, we have huge traditions of workers, self-education, pedagogy, and so on, right? So it's obviously not true, but there's still this kind of fetish. And I think we see it with the PMC, the kind of professional managerial class, the idea that ideas are not for others, like that the ideas are the preserve of an intellectual elite, like those who've gone to university, even though these people are manifestly, blatantly stupid in many cases, you know, and really don't have any capacity for critical thought whatsoever. Whereas somebody who's, you know, reading books in their spare time and also working as a mechanic. I mean, you have this echo in Wittgenstein where he's running around telling the sons of the elite to fix cars and become mechanics rather than philosophers. It's interesting, this recurs, this kind of antagonism or supposed distance between intellectual and manual labor. So I just want to note that as a kind of question. And of course it's a question for Marxism, and you know, when we move towards this knowledge or virtual economy, what are we talking about when we're talking about labor, right? People still make things are still made even in times of increasing automation. There are some forms of labor, particularly care work, that cannot be automated, and in many ways we should start by thinking about those first and foremost. But these often become kind of naturalized. This is often work that's associated with women. It's just somehow often seen as exempt from politics or exempt from the economy, as many feminists have been pointing out for a long time, as if it's simply a kind of a non-story in the background, that these things just happen, as it were. So yeah, I just wanted to raise that. But we can't blame the Greeks for everything. And I suppose in a way what we're almost saying is that we blame, well, what do we blame? We blame money and writing, but who or what is responsible for money and writing? If tragedy is a response to writing and abstraction is a response to money.
Yes. So, and I think kind of looping back to Nietzsche, who obviously, you know, we could kind of set over and against Zonuletel in the sense that he's clearly a sort of overt elitist, right, and defender of these kinds of distinctions of rank, right? And, you know, whereas Zonuletel is kind of, you know, trying to see how this particular hierarchy, you know, separating intellectual from manual labor emerges, and the way that the sort of Greek, the ancient Greek separation of appearance from reality, of truth from doxa, that this both kind of reflects the emergence of this hierarchy and in some sense sort of ideologically reinforces it, right, or reifies it, right, makes it, gives it a kind of philosophical legitimation. And so Nietzsche, on the other hand, is concerned about the kind of diminishment or collapse of hierarchy in this ancient period, as he is in the modern period, right, where he's concerned about democratization. He's concerned about the increasing political role played by the masses, right? This is the first time that you have the rise of, you know, the SPD, Social Democratic Party in Germany, that, you know, will go on to become, you know, the kind of largest mass party in the world for a while. So he is responding to these developments, even as he writes about ancient Greece and presents Socrates as a figure of the rabble, right, of the mob. So I think it's worth kind of setting them off against each other, right? So, but, you know, with Nietzsche also, we get this kind of question of who or what is to blame here. And his ambivalence around Socrates is quite interesting in this respect. So he says this is jumping ahead, I previously quoted from Birth of Tragedy, right, his first published book. I'm now going to quote from Twilight of the Idols, which is one of his last published books, produced during this sort of flurry of activity that he undertook kind of shortly before descending into madness in and around 1888. So he says of Socrates in the section called the Problem of Socrates, which opens the book, "His case was at bottom only the extreme and most apparent example of a state of distress which was beginning to be general, that state in which no one was able to master himself and in which the instincts turned one against the other. As the extreme example of this state, he fascinated. His terrifying ugliness made him conspicuous to every eye. It is quite obvious that he fascinated still more as a reply, a solution, an apparent cure of this case." So he's arguing here that philosophy as embodied by Socrates, which does appeal to the Athenian elite, right? It appeals to, notably, Alcibiades, right? The sort of great figure of, you know, the kind of flower of the Athenian youth, and sort of, you know, great figure of the Athenian aristocracy in this, you know, very tumultuous period, you know, is famously a sort of devotee of Socrates. So what is it about Socrates that appeals to these aristocrats? He's ugly. He's, you know, part of the rabble. And here, interestingly, Nietzsche presents him as a kind of doctor or a sort of witch doctor of some sort who's offering to them a cure of something that ails them. And what ails them is this kind of chaos, this kind of internal chaos of their instincts, right? Now, this sort of relates to what you said about, you know, his later analysis of Wagner, right? Which is that, you know, he has this notion of sort of societies that have entered into a state of decadence, and that you know, are on one hand, you know, constantly seeking ever more stimulation to kind of, you know, reactivate their sort of dulled nerves. But then on the other hand, they're sort of terrified by the effects of that kind of stimulation and the sort of, conflicted emotional states that it brings about. And so what they see in Socrates and his sort of rational dialectical procedures, you know, which are kind of set off against the instincts, right, that, you know, that are legitimated by a kind of distrust of the instincts, right? It's sort of that, you know, whatever your instincts are to be distrusted, and instead you have to kind of go through this rational dialectical process of questioning. And so in some sense, you know, he argues that this presents itself as a kind of cure for decadence, right? But he does see Socrates as quite an ambivalent figure here, right? I mean, we brought up the, I'm still fascinated by the Socrates truther theory, but, you know, that at the beginning of Twilight of the Idols, he basically puts Socrates in sort of an ambiguous position. You know, at the very beginning of the section, The Problem of Socrates, he says, "In all ages, the wisest have always agreed in their judgment of life. It is no good. At all times and in all places, the same words have been on their lips. Words full of doubt, words full of melancholy, full of weariness of life, of full hostility to life. Even Socrates' dying words were, 'To live means to be ill a long while. I owe a cock to the god Asclepius.' So even Socrates had had enough of it." So there's kind of this point which, again, goes back to The Birth of Tragedy, which is subtitled Hellenism and Pessimism, right? That all the great minds of all times arrive at pessimism. And then the question is how they manage to live in spite of that pessimism, right? And so the answer he provides in The Birth of Tragedy is that the tragic art of the Greeks was a response to this profound pessimism. And it was a sort of vital reassertion of life over and against pessimism, mm-hmm. right? Now, there and still in Twilight of the Idols, he sets Socrates' response against this, right? And says, you know, Socrates presents this kind of rational optimism, right? So he clearly sees him as the progenitor of this, the fashionable views of his own period, of positivism, of utilitarianism, right? Of this idea that society's ills can be cured through scientific improvements, progress. That Socrates originates these ideas through this kind of notion that through this rational dialectical procedure, you can arrive at truth and thereby come up with, you know, better, you know, more truthful understandings of the world. And that this optimism is against the tragic sensibility, right, which posits beautiful illusion, essentially, right? It posits the Apollinean, which is the realm of the dream, of the illusion, over and against the deep pessimism of the Dionysian, right? And so he sees here again in Socrates the origin of this modern positivistic, utilitarian, and progressive approach, which attempts to counter pessimism, right? Which he sees as ultimately failing to counter pessimism, and as ultimately only compounding the problem of decadence, right? Which is a sort of enervation that makes it impossible to generate a vital response to this pessimism. And so, you know, this is why Heraclitus, I think, he sees as a counterexample, right? As somebody who can face the sort of the flux of existence, right? The impermanence of things, right? Which is tied to this sense of pessimism, with a kind of, you know, robustness and vigor.
Even a kind of joy, really.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And a kind of affirmation, whereas Socrates is the origin of, you know, what he sees as this kind of wrong response, right? And I think he sees this in the pre-Socratic figures other than Heraclitus, for the most part, right? That they all set up this idea of some kind of truth that can be apprehended rationally, and thereby denigrate illusion, right, which is what he sees as, you know, what is ultimately necessary to produce this kind of joy and vitality that will counteract pessimism.
Mm. Although Nietzsche's relationship to science is also incredibly complicated, because he also does have time for Darwin, you know, perhaps because it is precisely a theory of evolution and movement and becoming, perhaps also for various forms of contemporary physics in his own time, chemistry, things that are kind of attempting to, I don't know, perhaps be truer, if you like, to the illusion, which is a strange thing to say, but perhaps to, you know, and obviously Heidegger very famously criticizes Nietzsche or diagnoses Nietzsche as the last great metaphysician, as somebody who can't give up actually on a kind of fundamental claim about reality, whether it's with the idea of the will or, you know, a kind of barely sort of disguised physics or, you know, physis, the idea of a force or something that is flowing. You know, it's very, very difficult to remain with the flux, right, or with becoming. And obviously we see in the 20th century figures like Deleuze and Guattari in particular sort of try to remain faithful to that impulse in Nietzsche and try to create a leftist Nietzsche, almost like an affirmative Nietzsche, a Nietzsche without the hierarchy and aristocratic dimension. Obviously, we have recent work like Daniel Tutt's book, which is trying to say you can't, and also Dominique Lussaudio saying you can't actually do that to Nietzsche. You know, that actually this attempt to create a left Nietzsche in Deleuze and others, Foucault, is a little bit of a you know, a feint. Like it's not really possible. You can't subtract the hierarchy and aristocracy out of Nietzsche and say, oh, we want this affirmative becoming Nietzsche, like the yay Nietzsche, you know. But yeah, I mean, but this is something that's in the Greeks too, right? This is the same question. You know, if we want the Greeks, do we want everything that goes with Greek society? Same. I think there is an issue here also for figures like McIntyre in a very different genre, people who are committed to ideas of natural law, even, or a certain kind of biological, anthropological claim about the best way for humanity to live. It's very difficult to subtract, let's say, an image of that world that is compatible with civil rights values or democratic ideas. You know, okay, the Greeks invent democracy, but it's a very particular kind of democracy. It's not the one that we imagine now. So there are all kinds of unsolved questions about our inheritance, I would say, from the Greeks.
Yeah, so perhaps to think about how these two approaches might be, if not compatible, at least, you know, attempts to resolve a similar problem, you know, it goes back to this basic point about splitting or separation or division, right? That seems to be the kind of central through line of what occurs with these first philosophers. You know, so what Zornweitel is interested in is how you can reconcile the intellectual and the manual, right? And how that, you know, and I believe, you know, along with the Frankfurt School, who's sort of critical of, you know, real existing communism in the Soviet bloc in his time, in part because it, as he saw, did not, you know, succeed at reconciling these two things, right? It continued to reify the split, and therefore it couldn't actually be seen as the creation of a new society that undoes or overcomes the commodity form, right? Because it still maintained the split between the intellectual and the manual. And so this, you know, this impulse, right, to in some way reconcile, right, what has been sundered in this early moment, right, and created this kind of inheritance that we all live with, is seen in one version there. Now, I believe Zornweitel was one of these figures who was briefly very enamored of the Cultural Revolution, right, in China, you know, precisely because he saw it as this kind of, you know, I mean, it was certainly a critique of expertise, of sort of the, you know, the power wielded by intellectuals. You know, it attempted to kind of reconcile the theoretical and the practical and all of these things, right? And so, interestingly, this is also true of many of these kind of left Nietzscheans, right, that they at least went through their phases of being Maoists because they saw this as, you know, because they saw the Cultural Revolution as kind of this, you know, representing this possibility of a kind of integration of theory and practice, right? And so Nietzsche, too, is concerned with a kind of reconciliation of what has been sundered or separated, right? And, you know, he's concerned with it for somewhat different reasons, because basically what he's concerned with throughout his work is the problem of nihilism, right? And of, you know, pessimism he doesn't see as necessarily problematic, right? In fact, he sees it as necessary, right? And I think this is part of how he would reconcile various kinds of science with his project, right? Because they simply affirm or kind of elaborate these ancient truths, right? That you know were expressed philosophically as pessimism. Nihilism is a kind of virulent pessimism, right? In which the pessimism is not counterbalanced with any affirmation, with any vitality, joy, etc., right? And so, you know, his interest was in how you really reconcile the intellectual, right? The intellectual realm, which I think for him had to, in some sense, lead to pessimism, right? And in that passage I read before, he argues Socrates himself, in effect, kind of acknowledges this in the form of his death. And, you know, despite being the progenitor of this kind of optimism, he sort of gives up the game, Nietzsche argues, in his death. That you have to reconcile the intellectual, you know, pessimism of the intellect, as Gramsci referred to it, you know, with I suppose some sort of optimism of the will, right? A sort of optimism of the will to power, to use a Nietzschean formulation, that again there is some need to reconcile the intellectual realm with something that seems to have become sundered from it or come to exist at odds with it, right? And so,
yeah,
you know, part of what seems important here as far as this inheritance goes is this inheritance of a kind of splitting, right? And then these various mm-hmm. modern intellectual projects that are about the effort to reconcile or to, you know, rejoin what has been sundered. You know, kind of going back to the origins of philosophical thought.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that synopsis of interesting. Zondrette and Nietzsche both trying to overturn this distinction, but in very different ways, right? So Zondrette explicitly says socialism demands the disappearance of the division between mental and manual labor, right? And until the commodity form is overturned, there will be no socialism, right? And that includes all of the countries really existing. Socialist countries that did not give up on the commodity form, right? So, but I think for Nietzsche, the separation is part of the natural hierarchy and the natural order of classes. You know, I mean, even though he sort of on the one hand admires Socrates for his populism, his vulgarity, and his liveliness or his life, or at least prior to the trial. It's, you know, there's something dangerous for Nietzsche about this democratizing of critical thought, of thinking itself, right? That it doesn't necessarily, shouldn't necessarily belong to everybody. but I mean, you know, the Greeks both posit that it should and that it shouldn't. And this is also our legacy politically and socially.
Yeah, so he really sees the danger of this as, you know, these truths are not for everyone, right? And this is I think what sets him at odds with the left position as exemplified by Zondrette, like that there's a profound danger in the divulging of these truths, and that's the danger of what Socrates does, right? And that these truths are, and again going back to these these pre-Platonic philosophers more generally, you know, I think what Nietzsche sees as sort of, you know, again, I think there's an ambivalence here, but what he sees as representing another possibility is the idea of philosophy as a fundamentally kind of elite activity, right, of a certain class. And this is a, you know, a theme of Greek intellectual life, right, that there is this kind of sense of being an initiate, of being a sort of, you know, member of a particular philosophical sect, and that, you know, this is sort of the in one sense, the alternative vision that he finds there and finds more appealing or less dangerous and corrosive than this democratizing vision. And in fact, you know, he often begins his books by saying, you know, this book is for the very few, or, you know, this book is for free spirits. And so he clearly sees himself as attempting to cultivate a kind of elite that will, that is not drawn from the broad masses, right? That is, and, you know, perhaps this is Cope in part, right? He wasn't getting very widely read in his time. And so he had to kind of come up with a justification for this. But no, I mean, I think it is consistent with his project more broadly, right? And with a sense of philosophy as something that is dangerous, right? And that for that reason has to be you know, guarded in a sense from vulgarization, and that it also has to be, preserved as the province of a particular elite. So any final thoughts on this question? To what extent should we blame the Greeks for the current state of the world?
Well, the more I think about it,
at least this particular subset of Greeks.
Well, I mean, you know, there is a kind of fatalism here always, you know, that we can't not be where we are now. And I think the Greeks were indeed a great genius race. I mean, Nietzsche disfavorably compares the Romans to the Greeks and says that the Greeks are genius and the Romans are just unphilosophical completely. And so that the Greeks produced, you know, this variety of archetypes of philosophers, and that they have this peculiar genius, which lies in the systematization and then this unmythological thought and so on, as well as the tragedy and art and the great love of beauty and all of these things we associate with the Greeks. So, yes, it's very hard not to love the Greeks, in fact, and also to love writing and love philosophy and love tragedy. So I don't blame the Greeks at all, ultimately, even though they actually are at the root of everything that we would both love and not love. And they invent dialectics.
So I find Nietzsche's ambivalence instructive and helpful here. So, and, you know, this is a characteristic aspect of all of his work, right? That he's never quite as condemnatory as he might seem to be. There's always a level on which he's kind of doing the opposite. And so his, overt praise of Heraclitus and his overt repudiation of Socrates, you know, kind of remind me of how he, after he's had his break with Wagner, and, you know, later on he writes this praise of Bizet's Carmen, right, as superior to anything Wagner wrote. And then in a letter he says to a friend, I mean, I was just kind of messing around when I said that. I didn't really mean it. Carmen is pretty good, but like Wagner is actually better. So anyway, you know, it's endlessly interesting. You know, he sets up Heraclitus as this predecessor, but I think in some sense it's really Socrates who he sees as his predecessor. And alas, you know, his dream of being the music practicing Socrates didn't really quite work out, but, you know, perhaps we can still hold out hope that such a figure will one day emerge. In the meantime, this has been Blame Theory. This was the first of what I believe will be an occasional series on blaming the Greeks, because there are many angles to that approach, because their legacy is so vast and complex, as Nina has pointed out. And so you can expect more coverage of this theme in future episodes. In the meantime, if you have not yet, please check out our previous two episodes on deconstruction and Judith Butler. And if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe to the Compact Substack, which is one place where these episodes are released. And also please rate and review us on your favorite podcast app. And if you have ideas for an episode or would like to respond to anything we've said, you may be able to do that via Substack or write to us, the contact information at compactmag.com. And we're always open to ideas, suggestions, references, etc. So thanks again for listening, and we will see you next time.